Hello everyone, this is Steve Phelan for People, Places, and Things, reading to you from the archives of American Heritage Magazine. This week we're starting a new article entitled The House of David, a Midwest cult that was really good at baseball. A curious story of religion, sex, and baseball grew out of a long-forgotten postcard among her grandmother's belongings, says Lauren Nicole in the summer of 2019. While cleaning out my grandmother's home, my mother and I came across a sepia-tone postcard tucked among a pile of old photos. The postcard featured 15 remarkably hairy baseball players. Underneath the players were the words, "The House of David Ball Team, Benton Harbor, Michigan, 1931. Knowing that my grandmother, by then in a nursing home and suffering from dementia, wouldn't be the best resource for information, I took to Twitter to share my discovery. Many were just as curious as I was, but a handful knew who the House of David Ball Team was, and they shared with me stories of the dark, intriguing history behind the players and the religious commune of which they were members. The House of David was founded in 1903 by husband and wife preachers Benjamin and Mary Purnell. Purnell thought of himself as the seventh messenger of God, and his wife the co-messenger. That was enlightened of him. Inspired by the belief that Jesus would return and restore the Garden of Eden, the Purnells practiced strict principles. Grow your hair long, stay clear of dead people, and abstain from wine, meat, and sex. After traveling the Midwest through the late 1800s and getting turned away from various communes and towns for their unique ideals, the corpse-fearing couple were banished from Fostoria, Ohio, for not attending the funeral of their daughter, who was killed in a firecracker factory explosion. They finally settled in Benton Harbor, Michigan, roughly 100 miles east of Chicago along the shores of Lake Michigan. It was in Benton Harbor that the House of David blossomed, and their fellowship grew from nearly 1,000 and their acreage to 100,000. Purnell was a believer in strong work ethic and generating income, so he quickly devised ways to busy his followers and turn his commune into a money-making machine. In a short period of time, a public zoo, garden, resort, dairy farm, restaurant, arcade, movie theater, bowling alley, amphitheater, and the world's largest miniature locomotive. I'm going to say that one again. The world's largest miniature locomotive popped up on the House of David grounds. They named their new amusement park Eden Springs, and during the first half of the 20th century, it was the Midwest's premier tourist attraction. To this day, Midwesterners old enough to remember the park proudly share their fond memories. The House of David was also industrious in the making and distribution of everything from ice cream and grape juice to string instruments and jewelry. It is believed that the cult invented the waffle cone, first introduced at the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis. Another byproduct of the commune's energy and entrepreneurship was the House of David Ball Team, formed in 1913. The long-bearded men dedicated themselves to the sport, and by the 1920s, the team was well-known across America. They played everyone from the major leagues to the popular Negro leagues, and they delighted audiences with their baseball tricks a la the Harlem Globetrotters. Their barnstorming team became so popular that they created two more, including the all-black Black House of David Ball Team, and they often recruited professional baseball players like Babe Ruth and Satchel Paige to sub in for a game or two. Spectators near and far came to watch the boys play across America, and the House of David teams remained a popular attraction until the 1950s. I like to think that while growing up in the greater Chicago era, my young grandmother, with bows in her hair and no idea she would one day be 91 and sitting in a nursing home, attended a House of David baseball game and procured her postcard. For decades, the Purnells and the House of David prospered, but a scandal divided the commune. Rumors surfaced that Benjamin had had sex with female minors of his commune. By the 1920s, over a dozen women had come forward. The press admonished Purnell for his sins and hypocrisy, and he was charged with a variety of crimes, including, quote, having sexual relations with women and girls as a religious rite, and, quote, defrauding his followers. The disgraced leader died in 1927 before he could be charged for his crimes. Living followers and townspeople believe Benjamin was the victim of false allegations meant to remove him from power or take down the House of David. In 2003, one of the few remaining House of David members wrote in the Southwest Michigan paper, the Herald Palladium, that, quote, yellow journalism falsely convicted Purnell, and that based on the testimonies from commune members, Purnell was innocent of his sex crimes. Though the judge tried to break up the commune, the House of David lived on. Mary Purnell and the head of the commune's board of directors, Judge T.H. Dewhurst, fought over leadership, and Mary eventually separated from Dewhurst and formed her own sect, Mary's City of David, next door. Both communes still exist today and are home to a few remaining members. Mary's City of David offers an in-depth museum which you can visit by appointment. Tourists curious about the commune and baseball league can learn more at the House of David Museum, located in nearby St. Joseph, Michigan. As for Eden Springs, that too still exists today, although not in its original scope. Shuttered in the 1970s, the park is now being rehabilitated by volunteers who want to see the park fully restored. Attendees can enjoy the park's original miniature locomotive or catch vintage baseball games in the summer. An interesting footnote. In 1972, Benjamin and Mary's great-grandson, David, was found guilty of stabbing and killing 20-year-old Janet Euland. Though not a member of his great-grandparents' commune, and known to be an unreliable storyteller, David claimed there was buried treasure on the House of David grounds. David died of natural causes at the age of 59 while serving a life sentence in prison. After doing research on the House of David, I came to learn that their baseball team was popular with sports fanatics. A couple of Twitter friends pointed me to an Antiques Roadshow episode where a man learned that his House of David ball team postcards go for $100 a pop. When I told Grandma she was the proud owner of a $100 postcard, she told me, "Ooh, sell it!" Another friend pointed to recreated the House of David jerseys going for $200 on Ebbets Fields flannels. I hate to break it to Grandma, but unless we have to, I probably won't sell her House of David ball team postcard. That one 5x8 by 4.1 inch piece of paper is worth so much more than $100. For me, it is a key to a fascinating and complex history, one that I'd like to visit in Benton Harbor, Michigan someday. It also represents my grandmother's past, a simpler time when watching a bunch of bearded believers play ball brought joy to thousands of adoring fans everywhere. Okay, here is a different article. Let's go to Best Memoirs of the Great War. A leading historian of World War I picks the best accounts of the war among the hundreds he's consulted in his research. This is by Edward Lengel, also from the summer of this year. I first became interested. Oh, well, let's read this one explanatory paragraph first. We asked Edward Lengel, a contributing editor of American Heritage, to choose his favorite memoirs of World War I and tell us a little about them. Mr. Lengel is the author of two acclaimed histories of that war, To Conquer Hell, The Meuse Argonne, 1918, and Never in Finer Company, The Men of the Great War's Lost Battalions, and has compiled an annotated bibliography of hundreds of personal accounts of the war at World War I Memories. I first became interested in World War I almost 30 years ago, reading through the war's great memoirs. They influenced my approach to military history, which is less about equipment and tactics than the human experience of warfare. I was also inspired by the great British historian John Keegan's seminal work, The Face of Battle. To me, one of the most fascinating aspects of World War I is how men and women with no frame of reference for understanding modern industrialized warfare faced and processed the intense experiences they underwent in 1914 to 1918. Since beginning my almost obsessive jaunt through the personal accounts of World War I, I have read hundreds of published and unpublished volumes of memoirs, diaries, and collected letters written by individuals from all over the world. Here are some of my favorites. John Lucy, an Irishman, finds, quote, a devil in the drum. I keep coming back to one deeply personal and gently introspective account by a poor Irish boy who served with his brother in the British Expeditionary Force of 1914. That book, There's a Devil in the Drum by John Lucy, published in 1938, stands number one on my list of top personal accounts of World War I. In 1914, Ireland remained under British rule, but trembled on the brink of civil war. It probably would have slid into internal chaos that year, thanks to the Home Rule crisis, had not the outbreak of World War I intervened. For a time, most Irishmen, on the surface anyway, stood side by side with the British in their determination to fight Imperial Germany. John Lucy didn't care about politics, and he certainly had little interest in what Germany was up to in Belgium. 2 years earlier, he and his brother had joined the British Army simply as a way to escape poverty in Cork, Ireland. By 1914, they were both members of the Royal Irish Rifles, and were among the first sent to France, and then Belgium, to resist the German invasion. John and Dennis Lucy fought at Mons, Le Cateau, and all of the British Expeditionary Force's other major battles in 1914. But only one of them made it out alive. John Lucy never forgot the last time he saw his brother. Quote, my brother's platoon suddenly got the order, unheard by me, and up went the men out onto the open grassland, led by their officers. Dennis went ahead, abreast with this officer, too far in front of his section, I thought. He carried his rifle with a bayonet fixed threateningly at high port, and presented a good picture of the young leader going into battle. I wished he had not gone so far forward. Not quite necessary for a lance corporal. He was exposing himself unnecessarily and would be one of the first to be shot at. I raised myself high over the parapet of our cliff and shouted at him, "Take care of yourself!" I blushed at such a display of anxiety in the presence of my comrades. My brother steadied a moment in a stride which was beginning to break into a steady run forward, and looking back over his shoulder, winked reassuringly at me. The beggar would wink. Forward he went, and out of my sight forever. John Lucy never quite managed to leave the military life. After a long convalescence in 1916, he returned to the front in 1917, a commissioned officer, participating in the Passchendaele and other battles until he was severely wounded by a German grenade in December 1917. Lucy remained in the British Army for several years after the war ended, but after a stint in Ireland as a businessman and journalist, he rejoined the British Army in 1940 to see service in World War II. He attained the rank of lieutenant colonel before he passed away in 1962. The next one's entitled Siegfried Sassoon's Memoirs of, quote, George Sherston. Siegfried Sassoon's poetry and prose captures the war's personal cost in a way no other writer of fiction or nonfiction ever managed. Informed by compassion and laced with bitterness verging on despair, his testimony demands complete attention. The reader cannot look away. Though Sassoon condemned the war, even as it took place, getting him in trouble with British military authorities, his perspective remains tantalizingly ambiguous. So long as the war went on, he wanted to share it with his men, in or out of combat. Sassoon's slightly fictionalized memoir of World War I was published in three volumes. First, Memoirs of a Fox Hunting Man, 1928. Second, Memoirs of an Infantry Officer, 1930, and Sherston's Progress, 1936, under the collective title of Memoirs of George Sherston. In that form, it stands number two on my list of the finest personal accounts of the First World War. Born to a modestly prosperous Kentish family in 1886, Sassoon attended Cambridge, and by his own admission, enjoyed a shallow and frivolous youth. He entered military service eagerly at the beginning of World War I, and eventually was commissioned a lieutenant in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. At the front, Sassoon's heroism was legendary. Danger drew him like a magnet until he became known by the sobriquet of Mad Jack. Yet Sassoon did not, unlike German Ernst Junger, value danger for its own sake. Totally devoted to his men, he seems to have sought action in a desperate attempt to do his personal best to bring the war closer to an end, or die trying. For Sassoon loathed war. Instead of ignoring or sublimating its horrors, he drank them in with all his senses, and then channeled them through his pen into some of the most searingly powerful war poetry ever written. In 1917, finally, Sassoon passionately and openly denounced the war in, quote, a soldier's declaration, demanding its quick conclusion to prevent further wastage of human life. Sassoon fully expected to be court-martialed for this act, and almost was, but the intervention of his friend, fellow poet, and author Robert Graves ensured that he was sent to be treated for alleged shell shock at Craig Lockhart Hospital, where he met and encouraged fellow troubled poet Wilfred Owen. Both men sought desperately to return to the front, and did. But while Owen was killed, Sassoon, despite his almost insane bravery, was wounded but survived to live a long post-war life. Despite the bitterness with which he had written about the war, and the psychic anguish from which he continued to suffer till the end of his life, Sassoon refused to politicize his experiences and opinions, in the process disappointing many of his friends. His Memoirs of George Sherston, the title character, of course, referring to Sassoon himself, represent the efforts of a highly sensitive artist to process and understand his feelings. Ultimately, the tragedy of Sassoon's account is tinged with self-deprecatory irony. Where Junger thrilled to the perception of his own bravery, Sassoon, an equally brave man, described one moment where he, as he described it, quote, after a short spell of being deflated and sorry for myself, I began to feel rabidly heroical again, but in a slightly different style, since I was now a wounded hero with my arm in a superfluous sling. I felt that I must make one more onslaught before I turned my back on the war, and my only idea was to collect all available ammunition and then renew the attack while the Stokes gun officer put up an enthusiastic barrage. It did not occur to me that anything else was happening except my own little show. My overstrained nerves had wrought me up to such a pitch of excitement that I was ready for any suicidal exploit. This convulsive energy might have been of some immediate value had there been an objective for it. But there was none, and before I had time to inaugurate anything rash and irrelevant, Officer Dunning arrived to relieve me. His air of competent unconcern sobered me down, but I was still inflamed with the offensive spirit, and my impetuosity was only snuffed out by a written officer from the Cameronian colonel, who forbade any further advance owing to the attack having failed elsewhere. My ferocity fizzled out then. Now recognized as one of England's finest poets, Siegfried Sassoon never quite managed to plumb war's meaning, at least not to his own satisfaction, before his death in 1967. Next, we have Ernst Jünger's Storm of Steel. The best-known German account to emerge from World War I, unquestionably, is Erich Maria Remarque's fictionalized All Quiet on the Western Front, which remains a staple in high school and college classrooms even today. The book was extremely influential in the interwar years outside Germany. In Germany, a very different kind of book struck a chord with the public, particularly after Adolf Hitler's rise to power in 1933. That book, Ernst Jünger's In Stahlgewitten, published in English in 1929 as Storm of Steel, captured the feelings of many German veterans who remained proud of their wartime service and did not consider themselves to have been defeated on the battlefield. This troubling but powerfully important memoir stands number 3 on my list of the top 10 personal accounts of World War I. Born in Heidelberg in 1895, Jünger was attracted to war from his youth and joined the French Foreign Legion in 1913. His father managed to deflect any possible repercussions of this illegal act, and when World War I began in 1914, Jünger was able to join the German Army's 73rd Hanoverian Infantry Regiment without difficulty. Wounded for the first time in 1915, he was promoted to lieutenant later that year. From that point on, Jünger, unlike Remarque, who saw very little action, remained in the thick of the fighting until near the end of the war. During his service, he was wounded several times and also decorated repeatedly, eventually with the Pour le Mérite. His final near-mortal wounding came in August 1918, searingly depicted in Storm of Steel. Jünger relished his time at the front, and particularly in combat. Echoing the views of many advocates of the futurist movement, he saw war as not only purifying but as a transcendental experience. The emotional impact of a night patrol appears in this excerpt from Storm of Steel. Quote, "These moments of nocturnal prowling leave an indelible impression. Eyes and ears are tensed to the maximum. The rustling approach of strange feet in the tall grass is unutterably menacing. Your breath comes in shallow bursts. You have to force yourself to stifle any panting or wheezing. There's a little mechanical click as the safety catch of your pistol is taken off. The sound cuts straight through your nerves. Your teeth are grinding on the fused pin of a hand grenade. The encounter will be short and murderous. You tremble with two contradictory impulses, the heightened awareness of the huntsman and the terror of the quarry. You are a world to yourself, saturating with the appalling aura of the savage landscape." Above all, though, Jünger was a conservative German nationalist. In his Storm of Steel and his 1930 follow-up, Copes 125, he took pains to emphasize that German soldiers never gave up on victory, but fought to the bitter end. This naturally endeared him to the Nazis, who eagerly propagated the self-justifying lie that weak and impure Germans, particularly leftists and Jews, had stabbed Germany in the back in 1918 and forced an end to the war. But Jünger was no Nazi. He rebuffed numerous requests to endorse the National Socialists and was probably put under surveillance by the Gestapo. Although he served as an army officer in World War II, he spent almost all of his time in Paris, hobnobbing with French writers and intellectuals. Yet Jünger, who died in 1998, left a troubling legacy. The contrast between his account and those of English authors like Siegfried Sassoon and Edmund Blunden is particularly stark, given the fact that Jünger fought mostly against British troops and more than once proudly described killing them in hand-to-hand combat. The fact that Storm of Steel remains one of the best-selling war memoirs in the English language today poses room for thought, if not concern. For more tales of women and men at war, Ernst Jünger's memoir, Storm of Steel, is among the thousands of World War I personal accounts listed in my annotated bibliography, World War I Memories. Other personal stories can be found in his books To Conquer Hell, The Meuse Argonne, 1918, and Never in Finer Company. Okay, we've got a couple minutes left. Let's do this one, or we'll start this one and come to the end of it next week. It's called Light Horse Harry's Tragic Fight for Freedom of the Press. The Revolutionary War hero and Robert E. Lee's father nearly died fighting a Baltimore mob in defense of an unpopular Federalist publisher. This is by Ryan Cole from this past summer. In the winter of 1778, fewer than a dozen American soldiers, entrenched in a Pennsylvania farmhouse, repulsed a British force of over 100. The skirmish, known as Scott's Farm, was tactically insignificant, but the derring do of the rebels and their leader provided a jolt of adrenaline to the army languishing at Valley Forge. Their leader was Henry Lighthorse Harry Lee III, a young captain of Virginia Dragoons, who had defeated a Hessian regiment at the Battle of Edgar's Lane, and later won a gold medal from Congress for his actions during the Battle of Paulus Hook. 3 decades later, Harry Lee was called on to defend another home under siege and protect the rights of free expression that had been won in the Revolution. But this time, the results would be quite different. The summer of 1812 brought a cloud of bitter partisanship that would make today's squabbles seem quaint by comparison. President James Madison's decision to declare war with Great Britain in June, egged on by congressional hawks, sharply divided the nation along geographical and partisan lines. The remnants of Alexander Hamilton's Federalist Party, predominantly isolated in New England, deeply opposed the war up to the point of eventually considering secession. Meanwhile, Democratic Republicans, the now ascendant political coalition formed around Thomas Jefferson, heartily supported a second fight with Britain. The city of Baltimore was a hub of Democratic Republicans who controlled its government and police force. This, however, did not prevent Alexander Conte Hanson from exercising his constitutional rights. Hanson was of patriotic stock. Originally from Montgomery County, the grandson of a president of the Continental Congress and the son of a former chancellor of Maryland, Hanson had established a broadsheet or newspaper in Baltimore called the Federalist Republic. Extremely pugnacious, he filled it with virulent anti-Republican insults. The publication had merged with another newspaper, the North American and Mercantile and Daily Advertiser, in 1809, and set up shop in the wooden home of Hanson's partner, Jacob Wagner, on the corner of 2nd and Gay Streets in Baltimore. From there, it blasted venomous denunciations of Republican politics and politicians. As a consequence, Hanson was challenged to duels and subjected to lawsuits. Even the city's few Federalists grew weary of his constant provocations. On June 20th, 1812, days after Congress's declaration of war with Great Britain, Hanson uncorked a particularly wild manifesto assaulting, quote, the patrons and contrivers of this highly impolitic and destructive war. It boasted, quote, we are avowedly hostile to the presidency of James Madison, and promise to, quote, hazard everything most dear to frustrate anything leading to the prostration of civil rights and the establishment of a system of terror that was sure to flow from the, quote, measure now proclaimed. Such statements did not sit well with the people of Baltimore. 2 days later, an angry crowd congregated under the moon before the offices of the Federal Republic, armed with axes and picks and hooks. They proceeded to smash their way into the house, tossed Hanson's printing presses, types, and paper into the street and destroyed them, then tore down the house they had been taken from. The city's mayor, Edward Johnson, did little to interfere with the horde, but Hanson and Wagner managed to scamper off to safety. The Federal Republican was not the only target of such violence in Baltimore. Angry Democratic Republicans had destroyed vessels alleged to have engaged in commerce with Britain and demolished the dwelling of a free black man named James Briscoe for reportedly declaring his affection for that loathed nation and its people. A church housing a black congregation was also in the crosshairs before the city assigned a horse patrol to protect the building. And that's where we're going to wrap it up for this week. We will continue with this story next week, and we'll get on to some other interesting snippets from the archives of American Heritage Magazine when we return next week. Until then, have a good time, everybody.